Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. For more than three decades, today's guest, Professor Ray Madoff, has taught law students the principles and subtleties of the U.S. tax code. She says it does more to shape American economic life than any other. The 7,000-page tax code directs the flow of wealth and capital in the United States. Professor Madoff argues that the rich get richer and inequality continues to widen in this country because of the tax code. In her new book, The Second Estate, How the Tax Code Made an American Aristocracy, Professor Madoff writes, "The American tax system is allegedly progressive, but seen in the full context of today's economy, it is in fact highly regressive. This system has been allowed to flourish by a combination of two factors, the intimidating nature of the tax code, which deters people from gaining their own firsthand knowledge of the rules, and the disinformation campaign, led in part by think tanks funded by the wealthy, that was designed to mislead the public about who actually carries the costs of running the country, and that is working people." Professor Ray Madoff says the wealthy have removed themselves from the tax system entirely, and it's time to bring them back. Ray Madoff is professor at Boston College Law School, co-founder and director of the Boston College Forum on Philanthropy and the Public Good, and author of the new book, The Second Estate, How the Tax Code Made an American Aristocracy. Hi, Professor Madoff. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Well, it's great to have you. This topic is so important and deserves so much attention. First off, how did you become a professor and an expert in the tax code?
That's a good question. I know tax does sound like something that would be very boring, right? I mean, I certainly had that misperception myself before I went to law school and even when I started law school. However, it's one of these subjects that once you get past the initial intimidation factor, you see how critical it is. Because for anyone who wonders how the world really works, breaking through to the tax code gives you a huge amount of information. It's like a little secret doorway into how money flows in this country.
When I first learned about your book and then started reading it, I have to say, the first thing I thought about is the 2016 debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And Clinton said that Trump paid no federal income taxes, and he didn't deny it. And he said, "That makes me smart." And the crowd cheered. So I wonder what you think about this, Professor Madoff, because over the years, we have heard over and over again that you should do whatever you can to not pay taxes because you cannot trust the government to spend your money. And you hear people say this over and over again. How do you think about that issue? And how do you think it should be talked about?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting. It's a transformation, of course, from how people thought about the tax maybe 50, 60 years ago, right? Where paying taxes was seen as, you know, the cost we pay for civilization, and something that people did proudly was pay their taxes. So I think Donald Trump is kind of the extreme version of another side of our tax story, which is he's right. People are free to not pay more taxes than they owe. Everyone, there's no civic obligation to pay more than your obligation. But I think that what was missing from that conversation is about how there's a separate problem, which is about the inequity that is built into our rules that legally allow so many of our wealthiest Americans to avoid taxes altogether.
Right. And we'll talk about that because that's one of the main elements in your book. How do you talk about taxes more generally, though? Because I was just thinking about going about my day, driving on a road, passing a school, going to the post office. So many of these things and these institutions are funded by our tax dollars. And yet it is very rare to hear a politician explain this in a way that is easy to understand and also is interesting, frankly.
Yes, I think that has been a problem. I think that what you say is absolutely right. And and anybody can realize that when you think about all the things that fund that come from paying taxes, as you pointed out, schools, national defense, local defense, the trash collecting, the support programs for elderly and unemployed workers. I mean, the list is endless about the things that our taxes pay for. At the same time, there has been a push by the right to denigrate government and government workers. And this was even before the days of Elon Musk, but of course we're seeing it in its full fruition today. And this includes such things as like, well, you can't trust the government, they're just gonna waste money. I saw this myself for many years. I would be involved in discussions about the importance of the estate tax. And a regular response was, well, we don't want to give more money to government. They're just going to waste it. But there are two separate questions. One is how big government should be, where I think there's different answers across the political divide. But a second question, which I think all of us can agree on, is once we decide however big government needs to be, how do we fairly allocate that burden? And I think not enough attention has been paid by the public at large to this question of how we allocate the burden. And I think there's natural reasons for that, but it's one of the problems.
Right. And if you don't have people talking about this, it's easy to just say, government wastes, I don't want to pay taxes, period, rather than having a discussion about what that actually means in a country of a little more than 340 million people.
That's right. And the other thing is that for the vast majority of Americans, they don't have a choice. Their taxes are collected by their employers. All of the information is reported to the IRS, and there's very little ability to avoid paying the taxes that one owes. But for the wealthiest Americans, it's an entirely different story. They operate by their own separate set of rules, but most of the public isn't aware of that.
How do your students respond when they learn about this, that the U.S. tax code, as you write in your new book, The Second Estate, the U.S. tax code imposes its greatest burden on people who work for their income, but the ultra, ultra wealthy can say that they earn a dollar and therefore pay no income taxes at all?
Honestly, it makes them feel like they want to take a shower. You know, we teach them about how these things work, and it's kind of disheartening. And particularly for students who often carry the triple burdens, I'd say, of carrying the debt to be in school, working extra jobs to support themselves, and paying heavy taxes, because anybody who works pays both payroll taxes and, in most cases, income taxes. And these are significant burdens, and it angers them to think that they have to carry all of this and the wealthiest Americans don't have to.
Let's talk about the title of your book, The Second Estate. You open the book by writing that the Second Estate was the official designation of the aristocracy of pre-revolutionary France. Members of the Second Estate enjoyed special privileges, including the right to hunt, carry a sword, and not pay taxes.
Yes. So the Second Estate were legally exempt from taxes. And so all of the costs in pre-revolutionary France was borne by the workers and the business people and the peasants and people who didn't have anything and people who had a small amount. And we know that didn't end that well. But it was... What's interesting to me is that the United States, of course, was founded on principles that were anti-aristocracy, right? Everything about the United States was a rejection of the life of pre-revolutionary France. So the question I was interested in was, how did we get to a place where a system that was meant to impose its greatest burdens on those who had the greatest capacity to pay instead got transformed into one where the richest Americans are able to pay no taxes at all?
I have to share this one factoid in your book because we've done a lot of shows about DuPont and Forever Chemicals. And this was really interesting to learn. As the French economist Pierre-Samuel DuPont de Nemours, who later fled to America with his two sons, one of whom founded the DuPont Chemical Company, said to the French National Assembly, in order to become noble, it is sufficient to become rich. And to cease to pay taxes, it is sufficient to become noble. So there is only one way of escaping taxation, and that is to make a fortune.
I love that you read that part. First of all, you saved me from having to mangle the name, which I wouldn't have done. But also because I think that was just such a captivating quote about really the state of where we are today in the United States. For people who don't have to work for a living, for people who have a fortune, they can avoid taxes, just like the second estate.
Today, we are speaking with Ray Madoff, professor at Boston College Law School, co-founder and director of the Boston College Forum on Philanthropy and the Public Good, and author of the new book, The Second Estate, How the Tax Code Made an American Aristocracy. Professor Madoff argues that the rich get richer and inequality continues to widen in this country because of the tax code. One of the numbers I've been reading about recently, Professor Madoff, is just this crazy number about what happened after the Trump administration brought the corporate tax rate from 35% down to 21%. I mean, they couldn't even do that in the George W. Bush administration. And again, that these numbers you can't even fathom. So the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy found that because of that drop, corporate income taxes for the fiscal year that ended in September are $77 billion lower than in the previous year. So that is so much money that, let's say, would be spent on social services or name it, but $77 billion in one year?
Yeah, that's a lot of money. The corporate taxes are kind of interesting because there's a lot of competing stories about who in fact bears the cost of corporate taxes, and those competing stories are deployed in ways that often are designed to benefit the rich. So, for example, when organizations are fighting to cut corporate taxes, they say it's important that we cut corporate taxes because that way we'll have more money to pay our employees and we'll be able to offer our products at a cheaper price. But when wealthy people want to claim that they're paying taxes, they'll say, well, we, the shareholders, are bearing the costs of the corporate taxes. So it's a kind of an interesting the way that the facts are twisted to suit the ends.
Right, and a lot of that money is actually used for stock buybacks.
Well, the story of stock buybacks, yes. Yeah,
go into that in your book.
Yes. The shift from how companies shared profits, how they previously used to share them by dividends, and now they share them through stock buybacks, actually is a kind of important and interesting story in the whole story of how the wealthy avoid taxes. And that's just one of the ways that it has come to be. And I hope we get a chance to talk about it.
Yes, definitely. And I think pulling back and looking at the big picture, this issue is so important. You write that the future of the United States and its economy depends on decisions the country makes today about taxing the rich. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think it's really useful to start with some numbers because I think that one of the things that intimidates people about talking about taxes is the same thing that intimidates people about talking about the distance of planets and how long ago dinosaurs lived, which is this problem of big numbers. Big numbers can be kind of hard to grapple with. But I think these numbers are really important to understand, which is, so I'm going to ground us in thinking about 2024. In 2024, and I'll use round numbers, the country took in from all sources, income taxes, payroll taxes, estate and gift taxes, corporate taxes, it took in a total of about $5 trillion. So from all of those sources. So that was all the revenue that the country took in. And at the same time, in 2024, we spent just under $7 trillion because we had more expenses than we had revenue coming in. As we know, it added to our growing, that deficit added to our growing national debt. And so we had to borrow an additional little under $2 trillion. Okay, got this? So we have $5 trillion, all the revenue. $2 trillion were the amount of money that we had to borrow to meet our expenses. Mm-hmm. At the same time, in 2024, the richest Americans owned $50 trillion. $50 trillion. So we had a deficit of $2 trillion. The richest Americans owned $50 trillion. And so when people say it doesn't matter if the rich pay taxes or not, I think all one needs to do is look at those numbers. Look at the magnitude of the wealth of the richest 1% of Americans in relationship to our annual deficit. And I think we can all agree that it definitely matters whether this group that has $50 trillion contributes to our national costs. The richest 1% own 30% of the country's wealth. And together with the next 9%, they own 60% of the country's wealth, leaving 90% of the country owning that remaining third. And much of that is also with wealthier Americans. So this extreme concentration of wealth amongst the richest of Americans and our growing debt, it's critically important that we figure out how to bring this group into the tax system. Now, people might ask, well, yeah, they had $50 trillion of wealth, but how much of that was income? And the answer is we don't know, and we can't know because they are not required to report the types of acquisitions of wealth that they have, because they have where working Americans rely on salaries and wages and gig work and things like that, basically compensation for their work. The richest Americans get their wealth through two means. One, through the growing value of their investments, and the other from inheritances and gifts. And both of those things have been entirely removed from our income tax system. So if somebody inherits $100 million and another person has nothing and earns nothing, those two people look identical on our tax data because the person who inherits $100 million doesn't even report it on their tax return.
So why don't they have to report all of that? Why don't we have this information?
Right. So there's a couple of reasons. One reason is that we count on the estate tax to serve as a backup to the income tax system, right? So we don't tax inheritances and gifts under the income tax on the assumption that we have a well-working estate tax. The problem is, as I write in my book, since 1990, there has been an assault on the estate tax, such that today it stands in name only and hardly produces any revenue at all. That's because Congress has engaged in quiet quitting when it comes to keeping up the estate tax, so that even though the richest 1%, which is the group that was supposed to be subject to the tax, have $50 trillion of wealth, and I promise you they are making lots and lots of transfers by gift in particular, which are supposed to be subject to this 40% estate and gift tax, the total amount raised by the tax in 2024 was $30 billion. That is 0.06%. This 40% tax had produced 0.06% of revenue. It hardly produced anything at all. And so, so we have this way our system is structured where the income tax has stepped back from taxing investment gains and inheritances on the assumption of a well-working estate tax, but the estate tax isn't doing its job.
You write that it can be very difficult for the average person to fathom how much wealth the truly wealthy have. And this has changed drastically in the last four decades or so. So if you look at the Forbes 10 richest people list, they always write about net worth. What does that mean exactly, net worth?
A net worth is the value of their assets minus what they have borrowed.
Okay, so let's go down this list because you cannot even put your head around this. So Elon Musk, net worth, $497 billion. We saw the headlines about the board approving a $1 trillion package for him recently. Larry Ellison, whose son recently bought Paramount, net worth, $320 billion. Jeff Bezos, net worth, $254 billion. I just don't remember, I mean, I was younger, much younger, four decades ago, but I don't remember seeing these numbers or hearing about these numbers back then. Yeah. Why has this changed so drastically just in the last four decades?
Right. Well, the names too that you didn't list who also have many, many billions are people like the Walton family and the Mars right. family who have inherited, again, $60, $70, $100 billion in wealth. They have massive amounts of wealth as well. The reason is particularly for the people, because the people that you talk about have growing values of their stock. And of course, you know, tech has been a huge transformation in this country, much the same that that we experienced this massive change during the Industrial Revolution, right? When all the industrialists were acquiring wealth never before seen. So in some ways, with this explosion of the internet and all that follows from tech, we've had this enormous growth of wealth. But what we haven't had is any way to tax that wealth. So, you know, we have this staggering growth in wealth, but it has all grown just on a glide path. Whereas if you think about somebody who's working for a living, right, even somebody who's earning a good salary of $100,000, they move forward $100,000 and then they owe taxes of about $27,000 when you combine payroll and income taxes. Then they move forward again, $100,000, then they're set back $27,000, right? And each time they're set back, they have less to invest and their money grows less quickly. But for our super wealthy Americans, they acquire $20 billion, $20 billion, $20 billion, $40 billion, $60 billion, $80 billion, right? They keep acquiring wealth and it's never diminished by paying taxes. That's because the wealthiest Americans don't actually have to sell their stock. And so they don't. What they do instead is they borrow against their stock to support their lifestyles. And this borrowing all occurs entirely tax-free. So in that way, they're able to keep the ownership of that stock, they're able to ride it up, and they're able to live their fancy lifestyles, never paying any taxes.
So this is a really important piece of your book that I don't know if a lot of people understand. So if you think about, I just looked up three companies. Netflix is going for $114 a share. Amazon, $223 a share. Nvidia, the AI company, $183 a share. I mean, people are making so much money off of the stock market, especially if you already have a lot of money. And it's really fascinating, I guess I'll use that word, to learn that the ultra wealthy often do not sell their stocks because if they did, they would be taxed. And once they pass, they then give those stocks to their children. So after a break, let's talk more about that because this is another reason why people are able to amass so much money. Today, we are spending the hour with Ray Madoff, professor at Boston College Law School, co-founder and director of the Boston College Forum on Philanthropy and the Public Good, and author of the new book, The Second Estate, How the Tax Code Made an American Aristocracy. Eileen actually writes, thank you for this show. Very interesting. Just the right person to talk about taxes to someone like me who knows nothing. This is just not something we spend enough time talking about. We'll be back after this. The This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. And you can find all of our past shows at kalw.org. Click news and Your Call. We have a number of resources also up there about today's show with Ray Madoff, professor at Boston College Law School, co-founder and director of the Boston College Forum on Philanthropy and the Public Good, and author of the new book, The Second Estate, How the Tax Code Made an American Aristocracy. Professor Madoff argues that the rich get richer and inequality continues to widen in this country because of the tax code. She says it does more to shape our economic life than anything else. It's 7,000 pages, and it directs the flow of wealth and capital in the United States. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Well, I'm sorry you're going to hear feedback. Do you want me to turn my radio down?
Yes, please.
Hold on just a second. Yeah, I appreciate the discussion, but, you know, the thing that's been left out so far, and I would assume you'd get to it, is why are these people allowed to do what they're doing, okay? And that's because elected officials pass laws from, you know, your local municipality all the way up to, you know, Congress that allows them to do it. So, you know, elected officials are never really held accountable for taxes. I mean, you hardly ever hear this kind of discussion in campaigns. I mean, they're willing to talk about everything, transgender issues, you name it. Just pick your issue. But what don't you hear about is, okay, why, you know, congressmen, why are you passing laws that are giving these people these kind of breaks when we don't have even a national health care system, which we could afford if we had proper taxation? So That's really where the, I think, just the responsibility lies.
Well, thank you for that, Greg. And Professor Madoff, before you answer that question, I want to bring in one example of what Greg is talking about. So when Kamala Harris was running for president, she said that she was endorsing Biden's 2025 budget, which included a plan to tax unrealized gains for the highest earners in the U.S. It would be great if you can explain what that is. But what really caught my attention is Mark Cuban was out on the campaign trail for Kamala Harris on a regular basis. But he said he would campaign against her if he thought she was going to tax wealthy people's unrealized gains. So to Greg's point, here you have Cuban stumping for Kamala Harris, but then she says he says, no, I'm campaigning against her if she goes this far.
Right. So I think that this issue has been made really more complicated than it needs to be, and has ended up in this place because of the approaches that have been taken to taxing unrealized gains. And I want to talk about what that term is. It's such an off-putting term. So basically, you mentioned these enormous acquisitions of wealth by our richest Americans, hundreds of billions of dollars. And if we think of any of them, you know, this is wealth that they have acquired over a certain number of years, and much of it, pretty much all of it, has gone untaxed. So that's what we mean by unrealized gains, right? So you think about Mark Zuckerberg. You know, he started on his computer in his dorm room, and now he has, you know, a couple of $100 billion, and he's not paid any tax on that run-up of value in stock. One of the, and that's what we call unrealized gains. They're gains, but they haven't been sold. Mm-hmm. And this is a huge issue for taxing the wealthy. As we talked about, they don't want to sell, they want to maintain control, and they don't need to sell because they can simply borrow against their assets. So the question is, how do we tax those? The answer that has been put forward to date that we see from Sanders and Warren and Biden is some form of an annual wealth tax, a tax on the annual increase or total value of wealth that somebody owns. And there are reasons why people, and so that in some way looks like the answer, right? Well, why don't we just tax them? We can see that their wealth has grown from, you know, $200 billion to $260 billion over the last 3 months. Why don't we just impose a tax on that gain in value? The problem is that that form of taxation raises a number of potential problems, right? To tax that growth each year poses some problems. One is it requires that people report every single year how much they own and what they own. If you think about it, they own all sorts of things. They own art and stock and jets and, you know, all the things that somebody owns, and you have to tally it up every year. So practically speaking, that's kind of, that's very difficult and it's kind of a nightmare. There's an additional problem, which is something that makes me concerned with a wealth tax, which is that if we had this type of annual tax, we would see more and more people removing their assets from this publicly traded stock market, right, where we can easily see what everything is worth, to private interests, privately held business interests, or art, or wine collections, or who knows what. And those things would be very difficult for the IRS to audit. And it would be detrimental for anybody who counts on the stock market for their retirement benefits or anything like that. So I think it would harm regular Americans. However, there are other ways of taxing this unrealized gains. I'll you forgive the term, but now you know that just means this stuff that's gone up in value. Mm-hmm. And this is a way that was proposed by Nixon and Obama and has been adopted and in place in Canada for a long time. And that is to say that we tax property not every year, but whenever the person disposes of it, either at death or by gift. Then we tally the gains on the property, and then they pay tax on it. That type of tax that comes up once when it's disposed of is less likely to result in people doing a massive hiding of their wealth. After all, they already, at least theoretically, have to do this with the estate tax. So I think that type of approach would be better and would be less polarizing than proposals for a current wealth tax.
And to Greg's point about the lobby, and we have a few emails about this, a Public Citizen found that nearly half of all federal lobbyists lobbied the federal government on tax issues last year. More than 6,000 lobbyists descended on Capitol Hill to lobby on tax policy. That total amounts to nearly half of all federal lobbyists. So given that, how do you change the system?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. But the answer starts with education. Mm. The problem is that people don't know about the flaws in our system, and so they don't know to complain about it, right? They've been misled, for example, about the estate tax. There was a big campaign that misled people to think that the estate tax was a tax that affected, was a death tax that affected everyone. And that's how they rallied public support in favor of repealing and at least functionally destroying the estate tax. But things go both ways, right? With education, with public support, we can get better policies once people understand where the problems lay. And I think that the real problem initially is a problem of education, because there's a lot of reasons why people think that the rich are already subject to heavy taxes. And when we have a minute, I'd like to actually talk about this this statistic that has done more than anything else to protect the rich. So to answer, yes, we have to worry about lobbying and all sorts of things, but we know that the public, if the public is armed with knowledge of the actual facts, they can hold their congressmen and senators responsible.
Well, let's talk about that part of your book. I mean, there's so many parts of your book about how the wealthy manage to pay no taxes. So let's just go over this, because I think this is so important. So the first strategy is that they're able to avoid salaries. The U.S. tax code imposes its greatest burden on people who work for their income: dishwashers, doctors, firefighters, lawyers. For everyone but the lowest earners, taxes are inevitable. But for people like Bezos, Musk, and Warren Buffett, they're able to pay themselves a dollar, and then that's their investment. I'm sorry, that's their income tax. So can you talk more about how that works?
Yeah. When you start to look at the salaries of the richest people, it's really quite shocking. So like, let's take Warren Buffett, right? The greatest stock picker of all time. If you look at their reports, Warren Buffett is paid salary and bonus combined, and he's never made more than this, $100,000. I mean, that's a fine salary, but not for the greatest stock picker of all time. Jeff Bezos has always kept his salary at about $80,000. This has been enough to allow him to claim the child tax credit, which he has, because his salary is so low. So he's eligible to claim it. Mark Zuckerberg, Larry Ellison, Sergey Brin, and others, they were paid $1 a year. And in some years, Elon Musk earned so little that the state of California, he just earned zero, that the state of California Fair Labor Standards went after Tesla to say, hey, you got to pay him more because, you know, he's not making minimum wage. So, so they are all taking these very low salaries because they know that salaries are taxed the most burdensome. But we don't have to feel sorry for them because, as we saw, they profit instead through the growing value of their stock. And all of that occurs tax-free.
So that's wild. I mean, how is that even allowed?
Right. How? Which part? The low salaries or the tax-free growth?
Right. Let's say low salaries first.
Yeah. You know, they're running the company, so they set their own salary. Right. Warren Buffett sets the salary of everybody, and as did Jeff Bezos when he was at Amazon. So they provide for themselves very low salaries. And of course, they can dress it up as something that they're doing, you know, as a civic good. Oh, I'm a dollar a year guy. I'm not taking anything. Right. But you know, they're getting massive amounts of wealth through the growth of their stock.
Right. So then, okay, and you point out that if you're an Uber driver and you make $100,000, you're subject to income taxes and payroll taxes with combined rates of 30% or more.
Yeah. So that's right. So if we look at two different people, right? One person who invested in Uber and one person who worked for Uber, the investor, you know, pays no taxes. And even if the investor sells their stock, they only pay 20% in taxes at most, but would probably, if depending on their income, might pay 0% in taxes. But the Uber driver has to pay, you know, 30% when you consider the state and federal income taxes and payroll taxes, which are quite significant. And often, surprising to people, because payroll taxes are called the hidden taxes because we often don't see them or don't even think of them as taxes. They're things that show up in our paycheck with funny names like FICA and FUTA, and they're called contributions, making it seem like they're voluntary. And so people don't often know what they are. And because they're divided up in different ways, and sometimes the employer pays half, we don't see how onerous those taxes are. But payroll taxes are actually, right now, they're at 15.3%, and they start at $1. So these are quite significant taxes. Somebody who earns $60,000 will pay about $9,000 in payroll taxes. And this can make a big difference for somebody at that level. It can be the difference of, you know, having a car or not, or meeting their monthly rent. It's a significant amount of money.
Tell us more, and we're almost out of time and we have so many questions. Tell us more about stocks, how the ultra wealthy have so much in the stock market and yet they don't sell their stocks because they don't want to be taxed. Why is that? And then what happens when they pass away? What happens to those stocks?
Right. So what happens? So they don't, as we said, people have stock. The stock goes up in value. Nobody wants to sell it because they don't want to pay taxes on it. And for people who pass it through their estates at death, they pass it by their will or some other way at death, they get an added bonus. And that is something called step up in basis. What it means is it's sometimes called the angel of death loophole. What it means is that when they pass the property to their kids all the gains are washed away, and so the kids can then turn around and sell the stock tax-free. So that's just one added benefit that we have for wealthy Americans who own property that has gone up in value. It's a double benefit. And again, it's justified somehow on the theory that, well, there's an estate tax, so we should just do this because there's an estate tax. But as we talked about, there really is no effective estate tax imposing real burdens on people.
The other part of this, again, this is very wild that people are allowed to do this. So the ultra wealthy are allowed to borrow against their assets. As you write, this is an extraordinarily popular way for rich Americans to finance their lifestyles while avoiding income taxes. So someone who may have gotten lucky and bought some stock and it's doing really well now, they might sell it to pay for their life, to pay for the basics, but they're taxed for that. The ultra rich often do not sell their stocks for reasons you just laid out. So they're able to borrow money. Can you talk about how this works?
Sure. So if you think about it, banks are in the business and others are in the business of lending money. The thing they want most of all is to make sure that lending is secure. And rich people have the capacity to provide that assurance by basically pledging their stock for a loan. So these are a sure bet. They're sure to be returned. It's very low risk for the lender, which means they provide very low rates. So if you're, you know, a multi-billionaire and you're borrowing money, people are very happy to lend it to you, and they compete to lend to you by providing low rates. What it means for the borrower is that they never have to pay taxes. They simply borrow the money. And even if somebody wants to have their money paid back, there's always somebody else happy to lend them more, because there's a big cushion between how much they borrow. No matter how much they borrow, even if you're like Larry Ellison and you borrow enough to buy the island of Lanai and every business on it, you still have plenty of excess billions around. So people are happy to just lend you the money, and they do so at very favorable rates. And you can always get someone else to lend to you, and they'll lend you money to pay the interest along the way. So that way they avoid taxes. Then when they die and they pass it on to their kids, or even if they pass it during life and don't get the step up, their kids can just do the same. Everyone can continue borrowing and not selling. And so that's they operate by entirely different rules. And then their assets keep growing at these enormous speedy rates.
You write about another story about Larry Ellison. In 2002, he bought a $194 million yacht, and his accountant advised him to slow down with his spending because his spending was like a freight train hitting a debt wall.
Yeah, and that was early on, right? That's before he was buying islands and CBS and everything else.
Wow. Well, today we are speaking with Professor Ray Madoff about her new book, The Second Estate, How the Tax Code Made an American Aristocracy. We're going to have you back, Ray, because we have so many questions from listeners. Let's go to a few calls, and then I'll try to read as many emails as I can. Let's go to Darius in Palo Alto. Hi, Darius. Welcome to the show.
Hello, and thanks for having me. I just wanted to start off by saying I am not a billionaire and I'm interested in learning how to utilize the tax code to benefit myself. I think a lot of people don't participate in the stock market right now and could be investing and kind of, to some extent, using the same strategy that these billionaires are using, but not at the same rate. So I wonder if you have any advice for the regular earner, the regular employee.
Thank you so much, Darius, for the question. I think one of the things, investments are definitely good, but I think that one of the things that people have to realize is that a lot of these tax privileges are really primarily available for people who don't have to work for a living, right? If Darius, you could get somebody to give you $100 million as an inheritance or as a gift, right? Then you too could benefit. Or if you could have your investments grow at these types of enormous pace and never have to sell them. In some ways, the sad story is that while there are some avoidance opportunities for people who work there, they're really nothing in compared to the avoidance opportunities for the people who have already acquired great wealth.
Well, thank you for that question, Darius, and I hope that helps. An important question from a listener: can you talk about raising the cap on Social Security, which would fix it in a minute? At some point, I figured out that all of us paying into Social Security get a good benefit for retirement, but those who make over, is it $140,000?
$170,000
is the cap.
Okay. And it's absolutely right. We should absolutely raise the cap on Social Security. So basically, people who have, so now for people with high salaries, you stop paying into Social Security at a salary of $170,000. So that means somebody with a salary of $1 million pays the same amount into Social Security as somebody with a salary of $170,000. And there's no reason that we should not raise the cap. This group should absolutely be brought in to the Social Security system.
Yeah, we're going to do a show about this. Thank you for the question. Philip writes, I don't mind paying my fair share, but I'd like to have a say in how the dollars are allocated. What percent goes to the military? What goes to the EPA, for example? So the National Priorities Project has a great tool. And if you put in, say you make $100,000 a year in federal income taxes, $20,000 goes to war and weapons. That is separate from veterans' health care. And then you have to scroll down to find the EPA. $717 goes to the EPA. So this is another important point here, Ray, is how tax dollars are actually spent.
Yeah, and one of the biggest problems, of course, is how it's spent now because of a failure to adequately collect taxes, because the biggest source of expenditure now is the interest on the national debt. That surpasses the amount that's spent on national defense, which is really shocking.
And we have just two or three minutes left. I'm noticing that there are more tax measures on the ballot. So cities are asking people to increase the sales tax or their property taxes to pay for parks or schools. Very, very important. But these are obviously regressive taxes. Yeah. So some listeners are asking, if there were two things you would change in the tax code, what would they be?
Yeah, one of them is really going to sound very obscure, which is that in 2001, which is to change the credit for estate taxes, which is basically the states use, it used to be the case that if people paid state estate taxes, it didn't increase their overall tax liability, their federal liability, because they could offset their federal liability with their state tax liability. And basically, all the states were able to raise money by having their own estate taxes. California, too, had their own estate tax. And George W. Bush monkeyed with the rules to make that no longer the case. And now it became much harder for states to have estate taxes because people would just say, well, to heck with you, I'm just going to move to another state and spend 6 months there, Florida or somewhere like that, to not have to pay estate taxes. So that is one I would absolutely advocate for. And the other is to bring inheritances into the income tax system. There's no reason that inheritances and gifts shouldn't be treated as part of taxable income. It's an acquisition of wealth, just like anything else, like found money on the street, and we should tax it accordingly.
And final question, Ray, how much longer can the system last as is? I was just doing some research on the struggle to make ends meet. Here's a headline from April, ABC7. A third of California's households are struggling to make ends meet. From June, Miami Herald, nearly half of Floridians are living paycheck to paycheck. And yet you've got people with so much obscene wealth, in large part because of this tax system. How much longer can this last?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that we are at a tipping point, and I think that we see this by both Mamdani and Trump, right? These both, they're both campaigning on the lack of affordability in this country. And I think that it's time that we turn our sights on the wealthiest Americans. One thing that has limited that is the statistic that 40%, the top 1% of earners pay 40% of income taxes, right? That makes it seem like the rich are paying taxes, but those are high earners, not high wealth owners. The wealth owners, as we talked about, have no taxable income, but that type of statistic makes it seem like they're big payers when they're just as likely to be non-payers.
Interesting. So it's like a lawyer making $600,000 a year.
Right. High income people are indeed paying all the taxes, but not the super rich.
Right. Such an important distinction. Well, we'd love to have you back, Ray, because we have so many more questions for you. Ray Madoff is professor at Boston College Law School and author of the new book, The Second Estate, How the Tax Code Made an American Aristocracy. Thank you so much for your work, Ray, and we'd love to have you back.
Great. Thank you so much, Rose. This is wonderful.
Thank you. And thank you for your questions and comments. We'll definitely do another show on this. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.